UK Wine Show, show number 71. Neil Martin on wine writing. G'day. Welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 71, for the 5th of October, 2007. My name's Chris Scott, and this week we're talking with wine writer Neil Martin. Neil started writing on his website, but has recently been employed by Robert Parker, the famous American wine commentator, to give a British perspective on his website. We're going to be talking to Neil about wine writing and how he managed to achieve the goal of what most people in the trade love to do. But before we get into that, let's have the news with Jane Scott.
Thanks, Chris. In the news this week, Australia faces a poor 2008 harvest and how genes determine our sense of smell. But first, research into wine packaging shows that glass is still by far the preferred format, with 63% of consumers agreeing that wine should only be packaged in glass rather than any other format. The rest, 37%, are happy to consider other formats, such as plastic bottles and bag-in-box. The research found that consumers perceive glass to be a sign of quality as well as environmentally friendly and easy to recycle. And with the industry moving towards lighter weight bottles to help the environment, they'll be reassured to hear that glass weight and colour aren't important to consumers when deciding what to buy. Much more important are great variety, promotional offer and country of origin. Only 13% of consumers think lighter bottles signify cheaper wine, and just a third believe they are better for the environment. Next up, the Australian grape harvest for 2008 could be more than halved due to the country's relentless drought. The normal crop is around 1.9 million tonnes, but could see a fall of between 800,000 to 1.3 million tonnes. The areas hardest hit are regions relying heavily on irrigation water from the Murray-Darling, in particular the Murray Valley and Riverland. It's known for certain that yields will be down in these areas, and since they produce high-volume varietal wines, the knock-on effects for big producers and consumers remain to be seen. Foster's has already made contingency plans to source from Chile, South Africa and maybe even Argentina. Their brands include Lindeman's, Rosemount and Wolfblass. And fortunately, they've already started to extend these ranges beyond their Australian heartland. And finally this week, researchers in New York have discovered that our genes affect our sense of smell. A new study has found that humans with different versions of odorant receptors perceive smells differently. Basically, those with impaired versions found unpleasant odors less intense and therefore less unpleasant than those with fully functional receptors. This finding could be one of the reasons why people react differently to the same wine and why wines with intense smells can be so polarising. That's all this week, but 20 years ago in 1987, the then Conservative government had set up a ministerial team to look at alcohol misuse. The Home Secretary, Douglas Hurd, said that people needed to be educated into drinking sensibly and more safely. Since then, I have to say I can't recall any hard-hitting anti-drink campaigns by governments, except the usual drink drive ads at Christmas time. It's interesting that the Diageo ad is now back on TV with their responsible drinking campaign that was launched in 2006. I'm not sure of the funding, but surely it should be a joint effort by government and industry. Don't forget you can get more detail on these stories on the news homepage of our website, 3050.co.uk. That's it from me. Back over to you, Chris.
Cheers, Jane. Well, I think we'll start with our Aussie drought. Last year's vintage was well down from average due to the drought, but this wasn't necessarily a bad thing. When I was over last year before the 2006 crop came in, many producers were worried about where to put all the wine that they were going to bring in. Supply was well ahead of demand, but last year's crop was low and it gave producers a chance to work through some of that excess stock. And with another year of low production, it looks like a shortage is on the way. This will almost certainly mean the end to some growers, but those who can grow grapes should see a rise in prices, which is always good. The second story about the different wine smells. I think we'll all agree that people do smell wine differently, even in the same glass. This is certainly partly due to training, and we can improve the accuracy with a bit of practice. But it is interesting how our genes do control how we perceive smells, and that some people have a blind spot for certain smells. A recent article I read on the sense of smell implied that our noses were much more sensitive way back when we used to hang around on trees. But our reliance on our eyes and ears meant that any damage to our sense of smell didn't really lead to a competitive disadvantage. The result was that those with underperforming noses didn't die off, and those poor genes got passed through to everybody else. As a result, we don't smell as well as we did. That sounds a bit strange, doesn't it? So it's not surprising that researchers have now come up with an example of this in our genes. The story on glass versus plastic is interesting. I think there's going to be a lot of innovation in packaging for wine coming through in the next couple of years, both because of the cost and the negative environmental impacts of glass in the UK. The problem with PET bottles, though, is that the packaging may be okay for high-volume consumer wines sold in fast-throughput supermarkets, but the lack of shelf life is my biggest concern. It would also mean that only cheap wines with high volumes will end up being packaged in this type. Not a bad thing. It may result in the wines being stigmatised. We're actually running a current poll on glass bottles. The question is, would you buy an expensive wine in a lightweight bottle? The options are, yes, lightweight bottles are more environmentally friendly. No, I'd worry about the bottle breaking. No, a lighter bottle would detract from the quality of the wine. And lastly, but not surely not least, not sure. I've never noticed a difference in bottle weights when buying wine. If you want to put your 2 cents in, please go to our website, 3050.co.uk or theukwineshow.co.uk and have your say. Next week, I'll give you an update on what people are saying. And don't forget, the show is brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. If you want to find out what our wine tastings are like, I still have 2 tickets for the Americas tasting in London on the 16th of October and a few more tickets for the tasting in Bristol on the 23rd of October. Sorry, the champagne tasting and the introduction to wine tasting in London are all sold out. Next, we have the interview with Neil Martin. Hi, I'm here with Neil Martin, wine writer and blogger. How are you, Neil?
I'm fine, thank you, apart from the word blogger.
Yeah, you're not a big fan of blogging?
No, I just choose not to use that word because I find it a bit doesn't sum up what I do.
Okay, you're now writing for E. Robert Parker.
Yes, that's right.
And you started doing that about a year ago, or just after?
Just under a year ago. Yeah.
Yeah. So what we're going to do in this is just cover, because you're one of the few bloggers, yeah. Or wine writers on the web anyway,
yeah,
who've come through and are now sort of in full-time paid work, which is a wee bit unusual for a wine writer on the web. So what I really want to do is just get an idea of your history, how that's come through. Does that sound all right?
Yeah, that's fine.
I had a wee look at your notes a wee while ago, and I noticed you went to Warwick University.
Yep, that's right.
Is that where you got into wine, or?
No, not at all. I was just, I think the only wine I drank then was Ruby Port.
Ruby Port.
Yeah, occasionally.
Occasionally.
Yeah.
If it was cheap enough.
Yeah, yeah, but I wasn't into wine at all.
Okay. So when did you first get into wine?
That was when I started working for a Japanese subsidiary. I was an administrator for importing wine.
In Japan?
Yeah, all the wine I sold was to Japan.
Okay, you're based in the UK.
I was based in London, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And what sort of wines were they purchasing?
All the top stuff, all the first growths, DRCs, Petrus, big quantities.
Did you get to try it, or?
Not in the beginning, but when I started buying a lot of wine, then suddenly the nice bottles started being offered at lunch and dinner and so on. So I took advantage of that.
How did you get the job? Was it because if you didn't have much interest in wine beforehand?
Yeah, that's quite a sort of. I've mentioned this before. I didn't know anything about wine, so I knew I was going to have this interview. So I went to the off license the night before the interview, memorized one of the bottles, which just happened to be a Liebfraumilch, so that the next morning when they asked me what wine I liked, then I just repeated the name. Unfortunately, the person interviewing me also didn't know about wine. So gave me the job, and
excellent.
And that was that. So.
That's quite a jump, isn't it, from Petrus to Libby?
Yeah, I didn't. Well, they would have been the same to me then. So.
Okay, so you're doing this job, and
yeah.
And you got to try a few of the wines.
Yeah.
Any of the wines really stand out, or what was your moment of epiphany?
Well, my epiphany was Monrose 82. That was the wine where I realised that it was. it was more than a just a beverage, or it had something intellectual about it. Not that I understood it then, but I could just see that there was something here that really interested me. So that was the wine that did it for me.
Once you realised wine was a big thing for you, what was your process? You know, obviously you've got to get some background information. How did you get your basic...
After that, I just started tasting more and more. I used to go to a lot of tastings and just reading. I was working on my own. There was nobody else who did wine in my office. So I just had to learn from, people like Jarcis Robinson or Robert Parker, and just see what they said about the wines I was drinking and buying. So and then I did a WSET certificate, Battersea College. You know, just I always remember lesson one was, you know, what is wine? That was the first question, and then we all just stood there. What is it? I don't, you know. I just went from there, and I just did that intermediate certificate, diploma, which I passed in 01, just about.
Just about,
yeah. Yeah.
Okay, and then since then, When did you first start writing about wines?
The first article I wrote was for Tom Canavan's website. That was on the DRC tasting, and actually from that article I met my wife.
DRC?
Domaine de la Romanée Conti. And so that was the first article I wrote in 2002. And then I started Wine Journal a year later, June 2003.
And the Wine Journal was effectively like a blog, really. What was the objective of it?
Well, it wasn't a blog. No, it was basically... it started as just over the years I'd collated all these about 7,000 tasting notes with some, you know, pretty good wines, and I was just bored in the office one day, and just went down to Waterstones and learnt how to write my name using computer coding, and to my surprise found I could do it, and then copy and pasted a tasting note instead of my name. And then 2 or 3 hours later, that was kind of really the basis of Wine Journal, because that's how much my knowledge kind of finished there, yeah, with computers, so I couldn't go much further. But it didn't need to. All I needed was an information-based site.
Yeah.
And then I put a lot of effort into the writing of it and the creativity and the creative side of it. So that's why I dislike the word blog, because blog's more, to me, is more like just a diary.
Yeah.
Whereas mine was... like a diary, but then I would try and make it funny or maybe a little bit poetic, or, you know, just to make it something that would be entertaining for people to read.
When was that? That was about...
June 2003. And it, you know, in the beginning it was literally like one visit a day, and that would either be me or my mum. And then it suddenly took off when I wrote a kind of account of La Fête de la Fleur at Mouton Rothschild after Vinexpo, and it was kind of quite I tried to make it quite funny. And
what was that? Was that a tasting, or
it was like a huge big banquet with, I remember Placido Domingo was there, and I think Catherine Deneuve was there, but I was just they were pouring Mouton 82 as much as you could drink, so I was kind of more concentrating on that, really. But I just I kind of just wanted to write something that was a little bit kind of, you know, funny and, you know, and entertaining for people, and it caught people's attention, and people seemed to like reading it. So I thought, well, you know, okay, if that's what people want to read, I'll write it.
And that's when you found your voice, is that?
Yeah, I think the internet is a perfect medium for, you know, if I wrote in print, I'm restricted by what the editor might ask me to write about or the amount of column inches. Whereas on the internet, you know, I could choose to write 100 words, 1,000 words, I could put as many pictures as I want with it, I could go on complete tangents if I wanted. There's no limitation to what you can do. And so really I just wanted to exploit that.
So your website was up and running around June 2003.
Yeah.
It was obviously pretty amateurish at that point.
Yeah, it was amateurish for about the first, I don't know, 18 months. And then I think the real turning point was when a good friend of mine, Joel, redesigned it for me, but in a sort of personal way that reflected me. I didn't want it to be like corporate looking. I wanted to keep the kind of the slight sort of anarchy of it, or the surrealism, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So he did a fantastic redesign, and after that, it had like an image and a kind of brand, and it, you know, you could
style.
See a style, yeah. That, and it, you know, it was very distinctive looking, so people could instantly recognise it, and that's when people started coming up to me at tastings and saying, "Oh, are you the guy that does Wine Journal?" Because you know,
yep.
They recognised my ugly face.
Yeah. Okay, so that was about November. Got it rewritten. How many? It's no longer available, is it? Or not under your old?
No, I mean, it got, by the end, it was getting, it had 100. Had about 145,000 unique URLs, people. And they were downloading about just under 500,000 pages a month.
Okay.
So it was one of the biggest sites on the net. And then I took it down, much to everyone's...
Horror?
Horror, yeah. I got a few emails like, you've sold your soul, and how could you do that? And it's kind of a strange thing. People kind of... I always expect you to do it for free, and it's like, well, it's took me, I was spending like 8 or 9 hours on it a day plus, to make it, so I've got a family to support, so
Definitely. So when did Robert, because you're writing now for Robert Parker,
yeah,
in erobertparker,
yeah,
.com,
yeah.
Is
yeah.
that right?
Yeah,
erobertparker. How did you tie in with him?
I had a feeling he knew about my site, apart from the exposure it had, because I used to do the music's a big part of the site, and one year I asked well-known people to ask what's their favourite songs of the year. So I had replies from Jancis Robinson, Andrew Jefford, quite a few winemakers, and I thought, I wonder if I can get Robert Parker. And I'd had an email from somebody who was his friend, so I emailed him and said, do you think you could ask him for his favorite songs of the year? And then 3 or 4 days later, through him, I got these, his favorite songs of the year. So I knew, he must be aware of it. But actually, I think he's very savvy when it comes to the internet. He knows a lot of, not just the big websites, but he knows what's going on there. He surfs when he can. So he knew about me, and then just approached me and asked if I would. Write for him and put the kind of two websites together.
So that was really changing from an amateur, because you weren't generating any revenue at that point, were you?
No, I was.
Oh, you were?
I was, yes.
Oh, how were you making money then?
I did it through a little bit of banner advertising and a nice affiliate deal. And I was running the whole website for £11.49 a month, so... I didn't need to make much money.
Were you living off it, or?
I could have lived off it if I was, say, in my early 20s without a family.
Yeah.
I couldn't really live off it with kids.
Yeah.
But maybe in the end I could have done. I mean, I would have done subscription for it, or for part of it in the end, because it had to go somewhere.
Yeah, sure.
Because I wasn't doing it full time. It was still like a part time thing. So if you want to do it full time, then that's a different, different kettle of fish.
So you're on board with Robert now?
Yeah.
Full-time?
Yes.
So you're a full-time wine journalist. You've made that sort of enthusiastic amateur right through to a full-time journalist?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I sort of considered myself full-time even with when I was doing Wine Journal, I think, because I was spending so many hours on it. And the output was, I wrote over 2,000 pages in 3 years.
Yeah.
So that's the equivalent of like 2 or 3 books.
Yep.
So that's pretty dedicated. So I sort of, technically I wasn't full-time, but I think of it as being full-time.
Your style is quite, it's interesting. On the one hand, I was reading a few articles in preparation for this, and I had to have a thesaurus beside me all the time just to work out what you were saying sometimes. You use quite big words, or not so much big words, but unusual words.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think I think you have to have a distinctive style, and I kind of like to write... I wanted to, in a way, I focus more on fine wine. It gets a bit egotistical and occupies this kind of rarefied atmosphere. And I kind of wanted to kind of prick the ego a little bit and say, well, it's just wine. So the way I write would be kind of about mundane things in life, or... the sort of stupidity of life, and infuse that into the article, so that on the one hand you've got okay, I'm drinking a dozen vintages of Petrus. But on the other, I would say, yeah, and then I drank the 89 with my ham sandwiches afterwards. And I think that's a nice juxtaposition. And the same with the language, you know, you'd have like maybe a slightly poetic sentence or with a long word and then go straight to something quite stupid and inane afterwards. And I just think that gives it a sort of contrast in the in the prose.
Do you read a lot of other people's writings?
No, not really. I don't really have much time. I try and read Giants' column in the FT. But I read mostly on the net. I think on the internet has the most interesting items I want to read nowadays. I don't really want to read about, you know, I know the areas I want to specialise in. So I prefer reading things on the net. Or
you can get a load of different opinions.
Yeah,
on something,
but I don't read newspaper columns or
yeah,
I find them boring.
Okay, sorry. So are all those people who write newspapers.
But it's, you know, well, apart from there's a couple of exceptions. You know, I love reading like Andrew Jefford and Jancis. You know, but the others don't really. I just find them a bit boring to read.
You like Jancis. You've talked a lot about Bordeaux. What wines are you interested in?
I mean, I've focused mainly on fine wines because I'm not... how should I say this? I think that Hugh Johnson said, you know, wine's worth talking about. And so, personally, I don't see the point in me tasting, you know, 100 supermarket wines. I don't want to talk about them. I like drinking them. So I'm not saying I don't go to supermarkets and drink those wines. But I won't sit at my computer writing reams about them. But if it's a kind of a wine where, you know, the producer has put some effort into making something special, then I think, you know, okay, that deserves some words written about it. So I focus on the kind of... It's not a value thing. I'm not saying I wouldn't write about a wine that's £5. I would do if it interests me.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to spend all my time doing it. I'm better known for writing about, you know, fine Bordeaux or Burgundy. And
do you write about New Zealand wines?
They're making wine these days. I do. I think I've got the trouble is that if you're going to write that much, I mean, if you're writing like, I was writing about 10,000 words a week. And if you're writing that much, you just don't have the time to kind of write about New Zealand in the same detail. And I would like to do that. So if I had the time, then I would spend time writing New Zealand, but I'd do it in the same detail as I would do Bordeaux.
Yep.
And I just don't have the time to spread around.
That's your little girl in the background.
That's Lily. She's actually features a lot in the writing. So
she's in the podcast as well.
Yeah, she features in a lot of photos. And somebody was saying to me, "Oh, we need to like copyright the photos." And I said, "Well, you don't need to because you can see Lily's head just in the corner if you look carefully." So, but yeah, that's part of the writing. I mean, I think people always say wine is part of life. Mm-hmm. So when I write, When I started writing Wine Journal, I was single. No, I wasn't single. I just started seeing a girl and I was living in a small flat in South London. And then by the time I started with Bob, I'd got married and had a child and everyone had read through that kind of... Precious. And you can, I suppose, hopefully, you know, people can relate to that. So so people kind of follow the story of Lily growing up and so on, so...
When you shifted over from your website onto the E. Robert Parker,
mm-hmm.
did you leave your old site up?
No, I think I gave notice. I gave 1 month notice. Bob declared it. He made a notice on his forum in the morning. And then, of course, I had to hand my notice in at work because it would go round the... And I was still working full time. So then I had to sort of hand in my notice with my job, which was obviously a big... I'd been there 10 years and... And then, so there was a month notice and I had a few emails from people saying, you know, you've sold your soul and so on. And, but But yeah, I took the website down a month later. Yeah. So there's still the page there. I kept the
homepage.
The homepage. But I took all the content down and now I have people saying, oh, can you send it to me on CD and so on. So,
yeah. Do you?
No,
because you've got to get a subscription to E. Robert Parker.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Have you put all your content back up on Robert's site?
It's going up. It's a long transition process because it's not just a... I mean, I changed my scoring system as well from 25 to out of 100. So I have to go through every single wine, proofread the note, look at the score and kind of transpose that to out of 100 and it takes a long time.
On that note, we'll wrap it up there. Thanks very much, Neil.
Okay.
Cheers.
Thank
you. Hope you enjoyed that interview with Neil. I'll be talking again with Neil about wine ratings and scores. But before I get into that, next week we're going to be talking with the people behind the wine show in London. I'll be running some wine walks there and helping out. And as a result, we have a number of tickets to give away. If you'd like to attend the show, please drop me an email with your name, address, and how many tickets you'd like. They're all on a first-come, first-served basis, but I've managed to secure a reasonable number of for you guys who listen to the show. Just drop me an email at chris.scott@ukwineshow.co.uk, and the show starts on the 25th of October and finishes on the 28th of October. A big thanks to Greg from my hometown of Dunedin. He contacted me late last week regarding the RSS feed from our website. RSS feed automatically would download the show onto your computer and or iPod or MP3 player, so you don't have to go to the website too often. But there was a problem with the feed, and Greg gave me a heads up, and I managed to fix it pretty quickly. But if you do have problems getting hold of the show, just drop me an email, and I'll have a look at what the problem is and see if I can help you out. We're not perfect by any stretch of the imagination, so we sometimes do have problems, and it's great to hear from you guys. And it's nice to have a chat as well when we get a problem. So that's chris.scott@ukwineshow.co.uk if you want to say hello or if you've got a problem. So until next week, when we're talking to the people behind the wine show, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Jane Scott, recorded and edited by Chris Scott, and the news is researched by Sandra Clement. To listen to other shows, visit www.ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.